Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how have animals and our relationships with them changed us and shaped our history? But first, birds, bees, whales, and turtles all use the Earth's magnetic field to guide them and their behavior. Now scientists have learned much more about how. With us is Andres Vidal-Gadea. He is a professor of molecular neuroethology at Illinois State University and has made fascinating discoveries. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Andres Vidal-Gadea. It's great to have you here. This research that you've done related to the magnetic field of the Earth and how all these species use it, quite fascinating. Your article starts with sort of a broad stroke about the purpose of the magnetic field itself, for the Earth, but also for the animals. Do you think we could start for our listeners with a bit of Earth Magnetic Field 101?
Yes. The inside of the Earth is made of molten material, and this is turning all the time, and pretty much like an engine is generating a huge magnetic field that expands far into space. This magnetic field, as far as we know, protects life on Earth from harmful radiation from the sun, and it also provides a very constant and reliable cue for navigation that animals can use to orient themselves.
Different kinds of animals use this. We know birds use the magnetic field to orient themselves when they migrate. What else? What are the other animals that use it?
Animals like bees, for example, and animals like mole rats, mammals, especially migratory animals like the birds and like whales and other organisms use the magnetic field. In fact, it was only because we weren't looking before that we didn't see how many species are capable of using the Earth's magnetic field to navigate. I originally got started on this on a sea slug that lives in the bottom of the sea and apparently uses the magnetic field to find its way around. So these things are all around us.
So do you suspect, as the scientist studying this, that really all species rely on the magnetic field as a source of information?
I don't think that all species perhaps use the magnetic field, but I think that the list is probably much greater than we anticipated. One of the things that I was very surprised to find out was, well, initially that these tiny little worms that live in the soil will care about the magnetic field, because normally people think of larger, more mobile organisms using the magnetic field. That kind of opened the possibility that maybe there are all kinds of little animals in the ground that are using the magnetic field all the time, and we didn't pay attention to it before. I think that, in my mind at least, animals that need to navigate in their environment are the ones that may use it, especially animals that, like the worms, that live in an environment that is devoid of other kind of sensory information, perhaps. They can use the magnetic field to help them find their way around.
So birds, of course, butterflies, bees, you mentioned whales. Your article mentioned wolves. How would wolves even detect the magnetic field?
There are a couple of ways in which people believe animals can detect the magnetic field. One of them relies on tiny little intracellular magnets inside certain cells of organisms, and this is certainly the case for some bacteria, and people have identified these particles in bees and in other animals. The second way that people believe animals can detect the magnetic field is with some specialized photoreceptors in their eyes. And this applies to many birds and other species. The idea here is that perhaps a photoreceptor cell in their eye, in the retina of these birds or animals, may be able to see the magnetic field just like we can see color. And from that, inform the animal which way they need to go. And so I think that in the case of the wolf and other mammals that people looked at, that's the idea that right now they have. But this is one of the things, right? We can do experiments that inform us that an organism can orient to magnetic fields, but it's a very different thing to find out where the cells that detect the magnetic field or how these animals are actually detecting. That's what makes it really difficult. And that's one of the things that the little worm we work with comes in really handy, because it only has 1,000 cells altogether. So it makes it a lot easier to hunt.
Let's talk about what you found and how you conducted the experiment. You wanted to see how this worm operates with the magnetic field, so you used a means of manipulating the magnetic field. Why don't you tell us the process, and then let's talk about what you've discovered.
sure. Originally, it was a very simple idea. I came across an article where some scientists have indicated that they found these tiny magnetic particles inside the worm. And having been working with this as an undergraduate, I was thinking, well, if they have these tiny particles in there, maybe they can detect the magnetic field. So the first experiment that I did was simply to put a magnet next to a plate which had worms in it. And after a few minutes, we noticed that the worms went towards the magnet. And right then and there, we realized, wow, these animals can definitely tell that it's a magnet over there. So after that, we tried to be more sophisticated. So we built a magnetic cage. And this is just a box that allows us to control the magnetic field within it. So we can dial any kind of magnetic field that we want. And sure enough, we started testing the animals in there. And we noticed that in this magnetic cage, the worms didn't just go along with the magnetic field, but they rather chose a particular direction to it. And once we started thinking about why will these worms go at a particular angle to the magnetic field, and after a while of scratching our head, we looked at where these worms came from, and we realized these worms came from England. And if these worms were in England, in the soil, the direction that they were going to the magnet was the same direction that would take them up or down in the soil if they were migrating to the earth field in England.
You had Australian worms, you had British worms, you had Hawaiian worms,
yes.
And you had equatorial worms. And yes. They all did different things, which is, I think, quite fascinating. Can you walk us through?
Sure, yeah. So most of the, if you think of an animal that can orient to the magnetic field, the great majority of animals, people immediately will think of birds that migrate north or they migrate south. These are animals that are moving horizontally, so to speak, in the environment. Now, the magnetic field, it has a horizontal component, and we use it to go north, east, west. These are the directions that we are familiar with. But the magnetic field also has an angle to it, to the ground. And so you could imagine the magnetic field being perpendicular to the soil if you were in the North Pole or in the South Pole, and being horizontal or parallel to the soil if you were in the equator. And we knew there were worms isolated from all parts of the world. There are worms isolated from something like 100 countries. And so we could easily get a hold of these animals and bring them to a lab, and then we test them. So the idea was the following. If the worms use the magnetic field like a bird to migrate horizontally, then worms from the equator should be able to do this no problem, because in the equator the magnetic field is horizontal to the parallel to the ground. However, if worms use the magnetic field to go up and down, then worms from the equator may not be able to do this, because in the equator, the magnetic field is not vertical. And this is exactly what we found. We found that worms that were close to the equator did not really orient to the magnetic field, but worms that were from the northern parts of the world, like Canada and England, they did this very well. And worms that were from the southern hemisphere, like Australia, were also able to do this. The trick is that in the north hemisphere, the magnetic field is pointing down, with the north pointing down, while in the southern hemisphere, the magnetic field, the north is pointing up. And so the polarity is reversed. And according to that, we also saw that Australian worms were moving at the opposite direction than British worms would.
You also noticed that if they were hungry, they reacted differently.
Yes, and this gave me a huge headache at first, because the first time I did this assay, it worked beautifully, and all the worms went towards the magnet. And then I tried to do it again, and then they went away for the magnet. And I was trying to understand why sometimes the worms will go one way and sometimes they will go the other way. Clearly, they could tell there was a magnet there, because otherwise they would just go in random directions. But in this case, they knew, but they were just trying to confuse me. And it took a while to realize that it would only take 15 minutes for a nice and happy, well-fed worm to start to feel hungry. And at that point, they decided to go the opposite direction. And so once we figured this out, then it was easier to do the experiments. But for a while, we just didn't know what was going on there.
So you had to starve some worms.
Yes. So eventually we decided to either run the assays with the animals that were just out of the food and immediately into the assay, or we could choose to just put them away from food for 15, 30 minutes and then run the assay, and that did the trick, right? And then the worms will consistently go either towards the magnet or away. from the magnet, and depending on whether they were hungry or starved. And of course, we didn't know why they would do that, and it wasn't until we measured where the worms were from and the angle at which the magnetic field enters the Earth in England that we realized that, in fact, what they were doing was kind of going in an upwards direction if they were well-fed, and in a downwards direction if they were hungry. So we don't understand exactly why that is, but it looks like if the worms are hungry, they tend to burrow down into the soil, and when they are well-fed, they tend to burrow upwards towards the surface.
Has there been research that ties humanity to magnetic field effects?
There have been some preliminary studies trying to see, you mean, to find out if humans can detect the magnetic field or are affected by it.
Yeah, and if we're just disoriented because we're from the United States but living in New Zealand, for example.
Right. Well, people have put humans in big, dark warehouses, and they have had kind of conflicting results. So it hasn't been consistently proven or disproven that the humans can detect the magnetic field. I can tell you that some of these magnetic particles that we find in all these animals that detect magnetic fields, people have found those in the brain of humans as well. And some of these receptors that birds have and some of the molecules that people believe are implicated in seeing the magnetic field in the case of birds, they have found some of these in humans as well. So I think that we have the hardware to do this. Now, whether we do it, I don't know. And it could be a combination of things, right? Mostly modern humans, we are extremely good with our eyes and finding our way around using our sense of vision. And for the most part, we don't really need to migrate great distances anymore anyway, like a bird or a turtle may have to in the ocean. We're pretty much set, and we don't engage in this huge migration. So perhaps we have it, and we just haven't had to use it for a long time.
Finally, I was wondering as I was reading your paper about whether or not technological changes that humans have made, if they alter the ability to detect any kind of magnetic force from the Earth because of the use that humanity has put with magnets, like using magnets in all kinds of technological products.
Oh, I think that that is certainly a possibility, and people have started to look into that. I am sad and at the same time happy. I can't see magnetic fields because we definitely surround ourselves with them, and if we could see them, we would probably be blinded by them. People have started to notice that even power lines that also generate any kind of electricity, any wire in your house or in your office that conducts electricity will create a magnetic field. And people have found that power lines are strong enough to confuse migratory birds when they are traveling. There is no telling what subterranean lines can do to the insects and other organisms that live in the soil. So I definitely think that we definitely have the ability to change how animals navigate their environment and how they go about their business by putting out these huge magnetic fields all around us and ever more powerful and more present everywhere, basically.
Where do you think your research is going to go next?
Thanks. And we are at the moment, we have this cell, we discovered the cell that can detect the magnetic field in this little animal. And at the moment we're investigating, I started my lab here at Illinois, and my students are working to find out how does this cell convert magnetic energy into neuronal information. There's got to be some moving parts in this little cell that are transforming one kind of energy into the other. And we believe that possibly the mechanism how this takes place is probably going to be repeated in many other species. So we are looking into that. And another thing that I have some students working on is we want to know what happens if you withdraw the magnetic field from around animals. And, you know, people are trying to make plans to travel far into space and go to Mars maybe, and And that would be far away from the Earth's magnetic field where all life has evolved. And so we are growing animals in a zero magnetic field chamber, and then we're trying to see what genes or what happens to the animal when that takes place.
Andreas Vidal-Gadea, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andreas Vidal-Gadea is a professor of molecular neuroethology at Illinois State University and has made fascinating discoveries. When we come back, how have animals and our relationships with them changed us and shaped our history? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Human history has been drastically changed by our relationship with animals, so much so that our next guest says it would have been a radically different world if not for animals in our intimate bonds with them. How have they changed us in the world we live in? With us is Brian Fagan. He's a professor emeritus of archaeology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of more than 24 books, including the latest, The Intimate Bond, How Animals Have Shaped Human History. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Brian Fagan. It's great to have you back here with us.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
So another fascinating book. This time you've looked at how animals have shaped human history in your latest book, The Intimate Bond. And your argument is basically that non-human animals have essentially contributed to what we've become, and that in some ways these relationships are more important than the buildings and artistic masterpieces. How so?
We really had a preoccupation in the past with the domestication of animals. Dogs, goats, sheep, cattle, donkeys, camels, whatever. Which is fine and very important. But what has been ignored is the enormous contribution, the ongoing contribution that animals made to human history, which in many respects are just as significant, as important, and as the rise and fall of civilizations. It's a very, very important part of the picture.
Now, you've also said that this is sort of intangible. So how do we know the history of the relationships and their effects?
It's a very complex story built up from a very broad-ranging way of sources. You can't simply dig up a bone and say, this is a cow. It's much more complicated than that. And this story involves sources of all kinds. It involves animal bones, which now, the study of which has become highly sophisticated and very detailed. And for example, with fish now, we can tell the weight and length of fish from fish bones, which is amazing. We know a lot about now animal diets and things like that. So that's a whole set of variables and research in high-tech science based on animals themselves, on the bones. Then you've got, and this people forget, is the context of the bones when found in the ground. You may find a donkey, as they did in Egypt from 4000 BC, buried in a grave with considerable ceremony. What does this mean? What role did this donkey have in history? And when we look closely at it, we find that its bones show signs of pathological wear, as if it had been a load carrier. But it was clearly a prestigious load carrier owned by a wealthy person. So that's another way we look at it. Then we look at historical records. There are, for example, fascinating historical records in that wedge-shaped script called cuneiform on clay tablets from a site called Kultepe in central Turkey, which document donkey trade between what is now northern Iraq and central Turkey in textiles and gold for several hundred years in the second millennium BC. And those records tell us about the prices, about the value of the donkeys, about the journeys, the length of the journeys, the size of the caravans, the correspondence between merchants at one end and the other, even wives complaining about prices not being paid and so on. It really is an insight into the past. Then you've got an enormous reservoir of information, which archaeologists tend not to read, about animal behavior. For example, we know a great deal about ranch cattle, which has a great bearing on the way in which cattle herders have treated their herds over the centuries. And then, of course, you've got Victorian records, government records, private records of societies dedicated to preventing cruelty to animals and all that. So the record straddles dozens of different academic disciplines and all kinds of topics. For example, if you take cats, everyone says, why did one not do more on cats? The answer is that cats are what they call commensal animals. They live with us, although they're domesticated. And their role from the beginning was prized as rodents, really, rodent controllers, before they became pets in Egypt, and so on and so forth. It's a very complicated story full of lovely tangents.
You went back something like 2.5 million years is where it looks like it began, and there have been major transformations in our relationships with other animals. If you could identify what the most profound transformations are over this time, what would you say they are?
The first, and really the history of animals from in the modern sense, goes back into the late Ice Age to 30 or even longer ago, when people hunted animals. They had great respect for them. And the relationship, which we can document from the famous Cro-Magnon cave paintings of France, are really very, very telling and can be related to modern hunters' attitudes to animals, where they respected the animals they hunted, they believed they had supernatural qualities, and so forth. That relationship is one of respect and mutual living together. The most profound change, apart from the domestication of the dog, which really was more initially, I think, as a companion and a guard dog more than anything else, when your real catalyst for change, the first one, was the domestication of farm animals, pigs, goats, sheep, cattle. That was huge. That was, 10,000, 9,000, 8,000 BC. They were domesticated in all sorts of places. And other animals were domesticated, like water buffalo in Asia and so on. And then you've got another real turning point, which was the domestication of pack animals, of which the most important by far was the donkey. The donkey was the pickup of the ancient world. I mean, it really joined civilizations and semi-arid lands. It's a remarkable animal. And that happened about 4,000 BC. And then after that, later, you got the camel and the horse domesticated. And those two, of course, transformed history. The camel conquered deserts and the Silk Road. And the horse, of course, became an instrument of war. And the relationship between people and horses, as you know, is very, very complex. So there have been all these stages. And then, of course, the final one is the Industrial Revolution, the industrialization of civilization, the plight of urban animals, and in the 19th century, the huge surge in the keeping of domestic pets, which really was the foundation for a lot of the animal anti-cruelty societies of the 19th century. So you've got all these stages, but really it's a continual story which raises a question. What is our relationship with animals? Are they our servants? Are they our companions? Are they our partners? Or are they a little bit of all of that? And that's a question that we really, as human beings, haven't yet quite worked out.
Well, let's go into some of the details of these individual animals and how they've contributed to human history and vice versa, as well as some of these other aspects that you mentioned now. Like, you talked about how animals were respected and in some cases revered, even in the very, very early early, early days of humanity, including living with them. And in your book, you also mentioned they knew them all individually. That's changed with some animals, but not others. What happened?
Oh, this very much refers to some animals and not others. I think what I really dwelt on it in the book was when I was talking about the domestication of the dog. And, of course, the dog's wild ancestor was the wolf. And wolves are very social animals. They live in packs. And, like humans, they tracked animals. And they watched animals constantly. One of the most striking things about hunters, traditional hunters, is the amount of time they spent stalking, tracking, and just watching animals. And in individual herds, they would know these herds really well. They know the young animals. They would know the increasingly female adults. They would know the age of the animals by looking at the color of their skins. And wolves must have had a similar, very intimate knowledge of their prey. But they obviously focused on the older, more disabled, or the young animals. And they would track and live alongside herds most of the time. And humans did the same. And there is little question that our very close relationship as hunters with animals was based on very close observation. It was based on a kind of cosmic view of the world, that we were in the world accompanied by supernatural forces, which included mythic beasts. And living animals were the living personification of many of these supernatural animals. And if you look at cave paintings in France, very often you'll see a human imprint on the wall where they've blown powder against their hands, and the imprint is there. And it is thought that that was people, and there were ethnographic analogies of this, people drawing power from the powerful supernatural forces of the animals painted on the wall, which lurked behind the rock. And you've got a lot of evidence from, for example, Inuit, that they always hunt with respect, they dispose of bones they don't eat, and so on. And it clearly is a relationship which was almost a partnership, not one where everyone lived happily ever after. But it was a partnership, and it was a partnership of respect because people depended on the animals. But then when you got to dogs and the domestication of dogs, it's clear that this happened in many places. Quite when it happened, we don't know. Probably, certainly by 15,000 years ago in Europe, Eurasia, and probably the Near East. And it clearly was a matter of propinquity, where you had wolf bands who were well known to the people who lived alongside them and watched them. They knew individual animals by sight, and you can be sure that some of the animals knew the humans by sight. And, I mean, I've walked among herds in Africa when I was young, and very often you'd see the same animals, and you got to recognize them. So this relationship is intimate. And when you've got sociable animals like wolves, and sociable people like humans, and both are scavengers, you can imagine scenarios where neither was really afraid of the other, because contrary to popular belief, wolves aren't particularly fearsome. They're rather timid, and they're very social. And it may be that the first domestication of dogs took place as a result of this close relationship, and maybe somebody captured some cubs or something like that, and the cubs became dependent on the humans and so on and so forth, and became companions and maybe even hunting dogs. We don't know. But that seems to have been the first relationship long before domesticated farm animals.
So the DNA of dogs is very similar to that of wolves.
The DNA of dogs and wolves is very similar. And the whole study of the DNA of humans and animals is still very much at an early stage. But it seems that there are changes gradually happening. But for a long time, a lot of the DNA of wolves, wild wolves, was still in dogs, and it persisted for a long time. This is an area which has got very complex, and much of it, again, is focused on where did the first dogs emerge. And the only thing that really came out of it is they were domesticated in several places.
Now, you also mentioned that historically animals were symbols of status, and that has seems to have changed over time.
It has, And it hasn't, actually, if you look at it closely, because what you've got is, on the one hand, a huge tradition which goes back thousands of years of rulers being fierce lions and great warriors, because the lion is seen as fierce. You've got bulls with powerful, virile animals who again became symbols of power in ancient Crete. You've got human dog gods who became bulls and emerged from the ocean. And you've got a real issue, and that is, if you're going to hunt something like the aurochs, the formidable, now extinct, wild ox, which was quite a beast with lyre-shaped horns, which when provoked was extremely fierce and dangerous. If you can hunt those with only a spear or bow and arrow, you've A, got skill, and B, got courage. And a lot of the prestige surrounding animals does go back to hunting and leadership and fierceness and leadership in war. But then you've got another type of status which is less conspicuous but terribly important, and that is the one of owning animals. If you look at cattle herders or any people who have herds, the number of animals you have is an important part of your life. It's important because it gives you surplus male animals, which you can use to throw feasts, to pay bride price, and for other purposes like that, to bring people into your orbit. And then you've got, in later times, the value of cattle as plow animals, and you've got the value of cattle as draft animals, and so on and so forth. And with donkeys, you had the same thing in Egypt. It was a very valuable possession to have a donkey. And if you had a caravan of 200 donkeys and you were going part of the way across the Sahara, you had clout, you had money, you had people who looked after the animals and went with them, and the loads were enormously valuable. The profit from it was enormous, and this gave you power and prestige. And then, of course, you get into the whole thing with the Romans of horses and great emperors mounted on horses, and the symbol of power this represents. You've got the symbol of the knight in armor, of cavalry, of Genghis Khan, all the symbols of power. There's always been a very powerful aura of power among many animals, among them, of course, eagles.
Then the other aspect that you noted in the book, but we haven't really talked much about, is this religion, spiritual role. How has that been manifested historically, and what has it become today?
It really goes back, and if you read your Homer, I was terribly lucky as a high school kid. I had a teacher for a couple of years who absolutely loved Homer, and he gave me a lifelong love of Homer. And if you look at Homer's poems, which of course date to the first millennium BC, and are really poems that were recited by bards at feasts and on special occasions, they time and time again dwell on the power of the bull, the sacrifice of the bull, the symbol of the bull for leadership and power, the association of bulls with the gods, and above all, with virility and the continuity of life. Bulls were enormously important, and they were enormously important, for example, in classical Athens, where there was an ambivalence about them. On the one hand, you kept them and sacrificed them. On the other hand, you ate the meat. And this was a complex business connected with the role of sacrifice in both a Greek and Roman society, where the protocols were very strict and involved animals. Today, I don't think really there are any people who worship bulls or treat them or any animals with particular divine sanction, although, of course, you get in Christianity the Lamb of God and things like that, but these are more symbolic things. That's really a product of a world where one was much closer to one's animals and where animals were wealth and power in a way they really aren't now.
One of the main ways it seems that animals have shaped human history has been the transportation aspect. And you focused on donkeys, on camels, on horses, and how much they've contributed to human history development. And a lot of this was around transportation.
Oh, indeed. Contemplate a world which existed, for example, among the Aztecs in Mexico, where the only methods of transportation were on water with rafts and canoes, or on people's backs, which provides an immediate limitation, A, to the amount you can travel in a day and the amount you can carry. So the domestication of pack animals was enormously important. It was important in the sense that it was a way of transporting goods and people. And people really underestimate the scale of the caravan trade in, say, the 15th, 16th century across the Sahara, across the entire Middle East, deep into Asia, the Silk Route, and so on. This was a huge, very complex enterprise which involved tens of thousands of people and animals. There were still a few camel caravans in the Sahara that carry salt, although they're gradually dying out in the face of the diesel truck with four-wheel drive. But there are some. And people don't realize that the relationship between the human being who led the camels and the beast was very close. The beasts carried the goods. The humans led them from one waterhole to the next. And this relationship was almost kind of symbiosis, where the two lived together. Very, very complex. And there's a marvelous account by a writer from the 1920s who went on a caravan in Mongolia and observed how these caravan pullers, as they were called, navigated landmarks that you and I just wouldn't even think of, leading their camels to water and to grazing. Very complex. But the thing that really helped the camel wasn't domestication of the camel. That was done in Saudi Arabia. It was the design of the saddle. And there's a marvelous monograph on camel saddles which points out that the earliest saddles were just kind of at the back end of the camel, where you kind of clung on. But it wasn't until they mastered the art of sitting high on the camel that people could fight from a camel or could carry loads in side panniers. And that's what really opened up the desert. But the animal that really is unheralded and neglected, and it's very interesting that with this book, the most powerful reaction to it has been to my emphasis on donkeys, is the humble donkey. It has some enormous advantages. It moves faster than a camel. It is extremely adaptable to semi-arid and arid terrain, will eat practically anything, and is relatively easy to train. They're also small, and they're also relatively cheap, and can be caravanned very effectively. In the early days, clearly, like the burial in Egypt I talked about, clearly they were very valuable. But later in Egyptian history, there were people who had 1,000 donkeys. And when you come to about 1100 BC in that time, with this trade in gold and textiles between Assyria, which was then what northern Iraq was called, and central Turkey, the trade was so lucrative that the Assyrians maintained a colony in Kultepe. And it's the records of this colony which has told us so much about this. And the price of a donkey in Assyria at the east end of the route and in Kultepe at the west end of the route was exactly the same. These animals had no value at all as a merchandisable commodity. They were purely a commodity for carrying loads who were worked to death. And it's no coincidence that, for example, a mule, which is, of course, a cross of a horse and donkey, was one of the primary transportation modes of Roman armies. Donkeys were a primary part of Greek farming. And all of this took place below the historical radar. They were the pickup trucks that you see on the roads that nobody ever talks about. They carried loads. They connected civilizations. They carried people and did so despite wars and pharaohs coming and going and all that. They were a terribly fundamental commodity, and I stress the word commodity. There may have been an animal. They may have had personalities. Some of them may have been better than others, but ultimately they became a commodity. And the biggest change in our relationship with animals is the moment when they really started becoming commodities.
One of the things about the donkey is that you saw it as so important that you essentially attributed globalization to the donkey.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Because if you look at Egypt, you look at Mesopotamia, you look at other civilizations, you've got deserts and semi-arid lands. And in many of these places, there were no waterways. And the donkey connected these seemingly isolated rivers like the Euphrates and Tigris with the Mediterranean. They linked the Tigris to central Turkey. And the ancient Egyptians, and this is some really remarkable research done by German archaeologists, the Egyptians, 3,000 years ago or more, were running large donkey caravans 200 miles into the Sahara to collect semi-precious stones from oases. And the research on these routes, which are very dry, is so thorough that they found the tracks, they found the droppings of the donkeys, they found the skeletons of donkeys that died, and they found caches of the clay pots in which the caravan carried water for humans and animals, as well as food, and the resting places. And it's clear that something like a third of the donkeys carried water, a third carried food, and a third carried the actual commodity which you were transporting. And this would never have been possible in some of the driest terrain in Earth if it hadn't been for the versatility of the donkey. They're grossly underrated.
Let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Brian Fagan about his latest book, The Intimate Bond, How Animals Have Shaped Human History. I'd like to turn to the horse, because so much of our shape of our countries and our empires have been influenced by the domestication of the horse. Let's talk about the history there. If not for the horse, how would our world look differently?
It would look very different. The thing about a horse, and this is something that often isn't little known, the horse was domesticated north of the Black Sea, quite when nobody knows, and quite when it was first ridden isn't known. Probably 4,000 BC, around there. But the thing about a horse is once you start riding it, you develop a very close relationship with your horse, because horses operate on a basis of feel and confidence, and they're steered by a rider who knows them. But the thing it really does is annihilate distance. And distance, when you have cattle or donkeys, is one thing. But when you have horses who gallop on open terrain, you can control herds over enormous distances. And as the Mongols learned, and Genghis Khan, of course, is the classic example, got organized and organized the famous Mongolian hordes, which actually were highly trained light cavalry, they really quickly mastered an enormous tract of Eurasia, part of China, and of course penetrated as far west as Hungary, where they annihilated medieval knights in suits of armor on their cart horses. And what saved Europe was the fact that Genghis Khan died and the general who was penetrating Europe was recalled for the election of the new Khan. But it really changed history. And then you've got, on top of that, the move south into Mesopotamia, the development of chariots. And one of the most marvelous things which I came across was there was a manual of cavalry horse training written by a man called Kikuli on some clay tablets in about 1000 BC, which really lays out a very strict routine. But it stresses that you must be kind yet firm to your horses. And this was so effective that it was used for centuries. And an Australian rider has actually tried the training system and found it works surprisingly well. And the basic principles of cavalry training were passed down right to the Crimean War. And in the Crimean War in the 1850s, there was a English cavalry officer called Louis Nolan. He wasn't very senior, but he was an incredibly gifted horseman. And he wrote a book about the training of cavalry horses. And the whole message was kindness, sensitivity, firmness, and so on. So a lot of the knowledge is very, very old. But the horse acquired prestige for leaders. It became a powerful shock weapon, although the Romans only used them as scouts. And of course, the height of insanity was in the 19th century, culminating in the idiotic Charge of the Life Brigade under Lord Carnarvon, and Lord Cardigan, of course. Anyway, the charge, which basically charged a battery of Russian guns, and half the horses and people were killed. But of course, what really killed off cavalry was the machine gun, the Civil War in this country, and then, of course, the Great War. Although horsemen were still used by the Russians in War II, and the Russians deliberately called them Cossacks because Cossacks, being Mongols, terrified German soldiers. So there is a long, long history with horse.
The book primarily looks at eight animal species as these primary relationships that have shaped human history. If you had close runners-up, what would they be?
The llama, of course, in South America, which I don't really cover. The llama has limitations in terms of the amount it can carry, but the Inca used them extensively in caravans between the lowlands and highlands and the Andes. That's a terribly important animal. The chicken is a very important animal, which I didn't bring up in the book. Somebody, a guy called Andrew Lawler, actually, has just written a marvelous book on chickens, where he points out that they're terribly important. Turkeys in this country were a huge staple in many Native American societies, and the list goes on and on. The one that reviewers have told me I should have spent more time on, as I said earlier, was cats. But I'm unrepentant, because cats, really, important as they are to us, are really a sideline in history. And, of course, were associated with black magic in the Middle Ages. So I kept them on the side.
You did keep them on the side, but you did write about them. They didn't get a whole chapter or anything. You mentioned the oldest domestication in Cyprus, and you mentioned their supernatural association in Egypt. So they had a special place.
Oh, indeed, and I am sitting at my desk, and sitting with me is my Maine coon cat. I think what he wants is his dinner, but he is looking at me very, very spiritually. Yes, they have huge presence. They have huge presence. We have three cats, but they have been, you know, animals of mystery and so on. They are my favorite beast.
Have elephants had an important role?
Oh, yeah. The elephants, of course, Hannibal, and they were used as war elephants. They acquired enormous prestige in India as Maharaja's mounts. Well, again, they were used for war horses, as load carriers. Oh, yeah, very important.
Toward the end of your book, where you talk about the changes in terms of, you know, cruelty to animals, protection to animals, and how that has evolved and where we're going as a society, in essence. So starting with this idea that cruelty to farm animals was not particularly new, and this, you noted, was particularly true among the British. But then we also had the development of protection for animals. So give us a little history there first.
The real concern with cruelty to animals really arose, I think, as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution with rapid urbanization, because then much of the cruelty to craft animals, for example, really came into city streets where people could see it at close hand. And from this developed the first legislation, which was designed to protect the conditions of working animals. And this resulted in some fairly ineffective legislation, but also in the formation of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which today is still a very vibrant, powerful organization, which documented cases and took people to court and wrote very powerful reports. And this gradually extended its mandate from basically working animals into pets, because the other big thing that happened, and the people who really were the impetus behind a lot of the animal cruelty societies, were a huge emerging middle class who developed an absolutely passionate devotion to pet dogs, cats, birds, rabbits, you name them. And our current huge pet industry has very firm roots in the Victorian middle class and the rise of animal keeping. But at the same time, cities were literally menageries of animals of all kinds, chickens kept for food, pigs, sheep, everything. It was filthy. But the domestic pampered pet really became the figurehead of anti-cruelty movements, which in recent years, of course, have moved far more into things like industrial-grade farming and penning of animals and so on. And that's where a lot of the effort goes these days. But having said all that, there is still a great deal of cruelty to animals. You read about it in the paper every day. You shudder. And a lot of it is just plain ignorance by people about what animals are like. My wife is a rabbit expert, and we keep rabbits, and we work with a local shelter, and we keep on hearing appalling stories of how people look after their rabbits. But they really are lovely animals, and it's, in a way, you've got to have a commitment to look after animals. And one of the great dilemmas of contemporary society is this whole issue of our relationship with animals, how do we treat them, how human are animals. And this, of course, on the more extreme manifestations, is reflected in the animal rights movements and so on. And the fact of the matter is we have a huge dilemma. Because on the one hand, we eat animals, we slaughter them, we produce them on an industrial scale to eat. On the other hand, we cherish and love them. It's no coincidence that many children's books are about animals. So one really doesn't know where this is going. I don't think anybody knows. The fact that I think we understand animals better now than we used to is very important, but there were no easy solutions.
It seems like from your last chapter, which looks over some of these efforts legislatively, beginning with a bill in 1800 in the House of Commons, and then the Irish parliamentarian Colonel Richard Martin, who campaigned against bear baiting and dog fighting.
Yep.
It seems like through time there has been certain specific acts made to be symbols of a humanity that we don't want to be, like barbaric. But that is still very species-specific and very act-specific. And how do you see that changing now?
If you go back to the 19th century, you have this huge, I suppose it was a cult, of big game hunters and their exhibits and their stuffed animals and so on. And there has been a huge revulsion against that, to the point now that big game hunting, which has huge status, has become basically, as we saw with the tragic thing of Cecil the Lion, a carefully managed enterprise for those who want to spend a lot of money. It's not a joke. It's sick, in my judgment. But that's one end of the spectrum. The other side of the spectrum is we have a huge, very vigorous hunting culture in this society, which covers everything from waterfowl to deer, much of it done in the market in the name of culling, and some of it is very well handled. But this notion that we hunt animals is very, very deeply ingrained in our psyche. We are, after all, coming off hundreds of thousands of years of being hunters and foragers. It's the same with fish. I mean, if you look at fishing, we're overfishing the ocean because we seem to think that we have mastery of the ocean. We don't.
I wonder if this attitude might start to change normatively as we evolve as a humanity.
I think there are a number of very intricate variables involved here. One is changing feelings about animals. The second one is the enormous numbers of people who have pets. But the third one, which is the silent elephant in the room, is that of population. And if you look at fishing, for example, fishing compared with 150 years ago is now an industrial pursuit. We are scouring the ocean. A staggering proportion of the fish eaten in China, I believe it's something like 75%, is farmed. And in a way, we are confronting a world where there aren't going to be enough animals for everyone to eat. And I don't know where that's going, because in a way, we are at a moment of truth where there are so many of us. And a lot of the values we've had in a world with many fewer people are going to be torpedoed just by the sheer pressure of people. And I think the pressures to eat more vegetable foods are going to be enormous. And I think this will be something that may change a lot of what we do. But I'm guessing. This isn't my field.
Two last questions that I wonder if we can draw from. One was, you noted that Britain had been known for being particularly cruel to its animals, but then it became sort of a world leader in animal protection. I wonder if we can learn anything from that evolution and in comparison to its neighbors.
The cruelty really stemmed from the Industrial Revolution, and the reaction against it very large largely came from an increasingly better educated middle class who loved animals, many of whom were urban, who are divorced from the world of the farm. And I think a great deal of the movements towards more humane treatment of animals, in fact, come from urban populations who are not familiar with the realities of the countryside, although the treatment of animals on farms is much better now than it used to be. So you've got a lot of forces all coming together. And the English have a long tradition of loving pets. They are known as, in certain circles, as the great British pet-loving public, and there's a lot of truth in that. And this has spread to other parts of the world. I would say in Western civilization now, the treatment of pets is really good, and I think this is spilling over into working animals. And the world is getting so much more mechanized now. I mean, when you realize that in Chicago in the late 19th century there were 200,000 horses in the city, and many fewer people than there are today, it gives you some idea of the scale of the horse industry at the time. Enormous. Now it's motor cars and trucks.
The final thing I wanted to look at was, you mentioned the vexing questions raised by the ethicist Peter Singer. Why we protect some animals more than others. What does your research suggest is an answer to that question?
You're dealing with very deeply ingrained values. For example, I spent some of my early career in Africa, and in an area where there were large numbers of extremely lethal snakes. And one's attitude to snakes. And when you went to dinners, people always talked about snakes. Snake stories were favorite stories. But the general litany was, you see a snake, you kill it on sight. And skunks are another one. Raccoons are another one we aren't particularly fond of. And there are animals that have these reputations. Like the wolf, in many people think is a hungry, angry predator. It's actually quite a timid beast. And I think a lot of this is stereotypes. And one of the things I think one has to do is educate people about animals in much more detail than we've ever done.
Brian Fagan, thank you so much for being with us once more on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure.
Brian Fagan is a professor emeritus of archaeology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of more than 24 books, including the latest, The Intimate Bond, How Animals Have Shaped Human History. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.